Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by The Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Gasso.
Hello.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And Cole Hornaday.
Hello.
How are y'all on this hot evening?
Sneezy.
Sneezy, coffee,
allergies.
I'm grumpy.
Ooh, I want coffee.
Come on, gang. We're doing the Seven Dwarfs thing.
Okay.
Come on. Grumpy. Which one are you going to be?
What,
I already covered grumpy.
Cutesy.
That's not...
Well, I'm happy, and I'll tell you why.
Okay, Ben Lawrence.
Because
you're not a dwarf.
Over at the Panel Jumper, we have a Patreon account, and we actually have a number of Patreons, and I just want to give a shout-out to those fine individuals support us at the Panel Jumper. So, if you... those individuals are Stephen McCandless, Scott O'Moore, Nicholas Rykar, Jessamine Bateman-Lino, Mark Brewster, John E. Boylan, Daniel Christensen, Jake Y., Mike Gilson, and Webster Polk. And I know every single one of those fine people.
Yeah, we do.
But,
we need more strangers.
I would just like to say a heartfelt thank you to everybody who
Absolutely.
Is supporting us. And if you would like to support us on Patreon, you can go to thepaneljumper.com and follow the big Patreon button. And really, it's not much of a financial hardship for you because we put out an episode, well, at least right now, once a year. But we're trying to bring that up. And the more Patreons we get, the more episodes we can put out in a year. Average.
We've got a script for number 5 ready to go.
We do have a script for number 5.
Got to get ready to go.
Ideally, we would like to put out a full issue quarterly, so 4 times a year.
Yeah.
We're trying to ramp up to that. We can do that. I believe in us, Cole.
I believe in us too, Ben Lawrence.
Join our Patreon. And believe in us as well.
While you're joining our Patreon, come on down to the Comic Extension and buy a number of comics, because I don't know if you guys have any like crowdsourcing web endeavors out there.
We have a
web store.
You do have a web store, comicsdungeon.com. Go and buy your comics there.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty. Now, let's talk about... Oh, this is going to depress me just because of the setup I gave it. But... we are in the midst of baseball season, and my beloved Mariners are doing the thing the Seattle Mariners do, and they look so good and so promising at the beginning of the year, and then they just, like, nosedive into the basement of the AL West. And so I get depressed every time I listen to the sports radio. But also, that brings me here, and that gave me the idea to talk about sports in comics. If I wanted to get my sports fix coming to the comic book store, how would I go about that? Now, I see, Chris, you're holding a book about, looks like Roberto Clemente there.
Oh, yeah. Neat. This is by Wilfred Santiago, who also did Michael Jordan Bull on Parade. And they are just...
All I can think of is Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I that's the only thing that kept on coming up in my Google searches. And I was like, I know that's what this is called.
Bulls on Parade.
Yeah, you got to be specific.
Yeah.
I have not read him. I should. I just don't do the sports balls.
We know sports.
Yeah. Fantagraphics put this one out. I can't recall if they did the Michael Jordan one. But I do like the style of it. You should check it out.
I will check it out.
See what you think.
Yeah.
I do like wrestling, though. And there are a couple interesting books about Andre the Giant.
Mm-hmm.
The Life and Legend, published by First Second Press, which is a fantastic publisher. I think they just had their 10th anniversary, by Box Brown. And then I guess there's a little bit of a... some people have some problems with that one. I think his daughter does, or granddaughter, or somebody.
And with the adaptation?
Yeah, and so the one that's actually approved by her is Andre Closer to Heaven by Brandon Easton and Dennis Midry. That's published by IDW. I looked at that one, didn't catch my interest. I really liked the first one by First Second Press. I think part of it, too, was interesting because there's recollections in there of some moments where Andre was a little racist. He apologized quickly, like he didn't seem to understand that he was being racist, or he was probably really drunk because he liked to drink a lot.
The dude could put it away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it focused a lot on the alcoholism. So I think that might be why some people in the family weren't quite happy with the adaptation.
Yeah.
And other than that, like I think I mentioned in the previous show, The Golem's Mighty Swing, which is about a Jewish baseball team in the 20s dealing with racism and other issues. And then the owner of the store recommended Superman versus Muhammad Ali.
One of my favorites.
And there is
one of my favorites.
There is going to be a new Muhammad Ali autobiography piece published by Dark Horse. I can't remember the creator who did it. So,
all right.
There's a kids book called Play Ball. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this at some point on the podcast. And it's about a girl who... she's a new girl at school, and she's really naturally very good at softball. And generally, the baseball team that's championship level, like, you know, they're all boys. And so she's trying to kind of fight the system to be able to be in there.
I just remembered Sullivan Sluggers.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
What's that?
That was a Kickstarter that was successfully kickstarted. I forget the name of the writer, but the artist is James Stakow. Mm-hmm. And it's about this baseball team that's basically, they're a bunch of losers now, and they go to town just to play local teams, and they get paid to lose to make the local teams look good. And they get lured into the small town where everybody is a demon that wants to eat them. So it's basically Army of Darkness meets baseball.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah, his art really makes it.
Yeah.
That reminds me of this Korean film I saw where a baseball team, I can't remember the name of it. It's Korean or Japanese, I don't remember.
No, it's Japanese because I've seen it too.
Have you?
Yes.
And it's a baseball team and it's there's monsters there.
Yeah. They're playing zombies and they're playing with body parts, and it's almost like a reference to there's an EC, a famous EC comic strip where they kill this, they like play baseball with this guy's body parts. It was one of them that actually went in front of the subcommittee, and I can't remember the name of it. I'm going to look it up.
You know the name of this Japanese movie I'm trying to think of? Email us at perfectbombpodcast@gmail.com. And awesome. Were you going to say something, Nicole? I feel like we cut you off.
Oh, I mean, I was just going to say who it was by.
The Play Ball?
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's published by Oni Press, and the art is by Jackie Lewis. It's written by... Nunzio DeFilippis and Christina Ware.
All right.
Yep.
And it's a kids' book, so check it out.
Yep. And you could always look up old Silver Age strange sports stories from DC Comics.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they didn't DC try to recreate that again in like a limited
Vertigo
run?
Series, I think.
Or is it Vertigo?
Yeah. And there's also from Image Mara, which is about...
Oh, right, about a volleyball...
In the future.
Yeah. Sci-fi volleyball player, like pro player. Yeah.
But it turns out she has Superman powers, and that was the plot. Spoilers.
She's a female volleyball player, but she has Superman powers?
Superhuman.
I get it.
But Superman.
She has super.
She's got flight and strength.
Man powers.
That's what I was hearing. Oh.
Yeah.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. No.
Like that's what makes her a great volleyball player, is because she suddenly has man powers now. Like that sounds.
She
odd.
Mean it that way.
Yeah. More muscles.
Anyway, cool. Well, Cole is he's
battlefield
shushing.
Baseball.
Battlefield baseball.
Battlefield was Korean. You were right.
Oh,
Battlefield.
Was Korean.
Yes. Good job. Excellent. Battlefield baseball, made in 2003. Gee whiz.
I can't remember where or when or why I
think
saw
it's on
that.
Netflix.
It's probably I saw it like in a theater setting with a bunch of people, or in a house. A friend of ours would often host weird movie nights at his house, and it might have been there. It's just, it was awesome.
I just had another just random thought. I love sports themed supervillains, and there's one called the Sportsmaster, who's just really good at sports.
Yep.
So he would just be bragging and be like, "I could beat you with a football."
And he does.
And or tennis or something. Yeah.
Excellent. Now I remember how I saw that movie. It was actually at Annex. It was at Annex Theater, the theater that Cole and I hang out in. And it was for our AD's boyfriend's birthday. Mm. And they showed that movie. Mm. And that's why I saw it. And
it was a James Weidman movie night.
Special feature.
It was a James Weidman movie night. Hello, James.
Hey, James.
We'll tag you in this episode so you
never
listen
to this show.
All right. Anyway, let's move on. Thank you all for indulging my sports needs.
Absolutely.
And go Mariners.
Absolutely.
So In the movie world, we have what is called a director's cut, and this is where a director of a film convinces the studio to release a version of the film that he wanted to release mm-hmm. after the movie has already been released mm-hmm. in the theaters. Mm-hmm. Now, in the course of a releasing movie, many, many people get their hands on it, and so a movie tries to get as cut down and changed as possible to sell tickets. Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering if there are... Is there if there's an analog to the director's cut in the comic book world?
So the problem is that the term's thrown around a lot, mm-hmm. but it's not accurate to what you just described.
Okay.
So, for example, in the current order form, I could order the Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle crossover director's cut number one. What they do is that they turn it black and white. And they might make the paper a little bit nicer, and there might be editor notes throughout mm-hmm. it, and that's a director's cut. Mm-hmm. But there's actual no missing story content.
It's the same thing, but they've annotated it and just taken the color away.
Right,
and
so it's more like a prestige style.
That's weird.
Like this.
Yeah.
Weird. Yeah. This is so right now there's a very popular thing in the industry about doing artist editions or mm-hmm. artist proof editions. And so IDW and Image do theirs, and IDW calls them the pen and ink, and it reproduces an entire issue in oversized format in black and white with little like director notes from mm-hmm. the writer and the artist. So that's their standing concept of a director's cut mm-hmm. in the industry. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'm actually hard pressed to think of an example of something where a new edition's been released where, like, the original creators were allowed to change back to something.
Yeah.
Except for the Killing Joke. They allowed Brian Boland to go in and recolor it the way he wanted it to color.
Did he not originally color it?
I think he did, but he couldn't do exactly what he wanted. And okay. I think they had to allow for some changes to happen. So the current new hardcover edition is, like, his design of coloring.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Mm. So besides that, I'm hard pressed to think of something.
Cole, you're holding something.
Yeah. Well, I've got two of my favorite books of that were part of Rick Veitch's incomplete King Hell Heroica. What he did with these are his satire and criticism, deep, deep criticism of superhero genre comics, in particular DC comics. What he did was go back. Let me go back a bit. The first series he produced was called Brat Pack, which was a direct response to the killing of the second Robin, Jason Todd, via 1-900 number, and his criticism of that whole process and reviewing it as for what he saw it as being a money grab.
Then the sidebar, that's what the next issue of the panel jumper is going to
right,
be about.
That's right. And then the second series he did was called The Maximortal, and this was a very close examination of how the original creators, Siegel and Schuster, were treated by DC Comics in the creation of Superman and the publishing of Superman. But he retells both of these stories in a much more psychedelic, crude, and brutal setting. Well, what eventually happened is that he decided he would tie these stories together. So when he reprinted them, he these are all self-published, by the by. And when he reprinted them, he made Maximortal the first arc of the King Hell Heroica. And he added some pages to the original Maximortal story. Then he reprinted Brat Pack and included pages that would tie it back directly to the Maximortal. None of that material was available in the original printing. Now, Brat Pack, the collected edition, which has material that was not found in the original published edition, that was printed, Chris, do you remember?
Oh, I can't remember.
This is a while back. So this was printed back in 1993, and then Maximortal was printed in like 96. Sadly, Mr. Veitch has never completed his King Hill Heroica cycle, and I know someone who's acquainted with Mr. Veitch, and apparently Mr. Veitch has no intention of ever finishing the cycle. He felt like there's no point in discussing it anymore.
Does that bum you out?
Yeah, it actually really does bum me out because I just reread these stories in researching our next episode of The Panel Jumper, and they're vicious and they are inspired, and it's a type of criticism. It's a critical voice on the industry that we do not have right now. And I'm still tempted to write Mr. Veach a letter and say, actually, no, I think this is a really good time for you to be cross-examining how we're looking at the genre, particularly with the how they've become, how the industry has exploded with movies. I think your voice is really important right now. But I, you know, if you were to ask me what should I read, the individual issues or the trades, I would read the trades because they are tied together. There are two super special issues that are not found in either of these collected editions. You can probably live without reading. But the biggest tragedy is that whatever he was planning to do with this King Hail Heroica arc has not been completed for over, 20 years? Yeah.
I just remembered Mark Waid did a run of Captain America. When they rebirthed Marvel years back, it was like Marvel Reborn or something after the Captain or the Rob Liefeld stuff.
Right,
which rebirth event was that?
Yeah.
They let the Image kids tackle all of the big gun titles, and
so after that, he had like an issue 12 or 13 was like a big Red Skull issue where it was all from Red Skull's point of view in his mind, and it was like a black and white comic except with red highlights. And the actual issue was published without Mark Waid's name because they apparently changed the script or something in the art so much that he felt that it didn't reflect his actual content. So he threw a big hissy fit.
He's
on
like,
it.
He's like, take my name off of it.
Yeah, exactly. So the new printings of the newest trades or whatever include his name because they kissed and made up. And I think they reverted the story so that you can see what he originally meant to be there. Because a lot of it was like the Nazi's point of view and like his worldview and this really messed up like mental mindscape thing. So I think Marvel at that point was just like, no, we don't want to show that a certain way. So that could be an example of like a director's cut where they could finally go back and put in the original intended material.
Cool. Is there any, is it uncommon for a reprint to have different material than the original run?
No, actually, it's happening more often now, especially because certain books that were kind of creator-owned at a publisher, they will never be reprinted because the publisher doesn't care anymore. But the publisher still holds the rights to reprint them until 10 years lapse. Then it reverts back to the creative team.
Oh.
So, for example, there was a DC book called Bloodhound, and it had crossovers with Firestorm from DC. So the rights have finally reverted back to the creators. They took it to Dark Horse. They have to omit everything with that character in it.
Weird.
What a pain.
And same thing happened with another DC project called The Golem by Jimmy Palmiotti and Phil Winslade. Batman showed up. Rights reverted back to creators. They published it at Image. No Batman. And that happens from time to time. Where
interesting.
They finally get it, but they have to omit entire chunks of story
because they're including those characters to improve sales of a book that's otherwise an independent project or a creator-owned project.
Right. And unfortunately, those sequences were looped into a plot because they were forced to do it. So by omitting certain sequences, the whole thing's changed. And you either have to rewrite and redraw certain sequences. In a weird connection to our last episode about the Max, in the Max comics, he fights a villain, shark villain that's from the Savage Dragon. Mm-hmm. And the Savage Dragon shows up in the comic. In the cartoon, they couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So the shark is still there because he's just a generic shark monster. But there's no Savage Dragon appearance. And they don't mention anything that the shark mentioned that had to do with Savage Dragon. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get those weird missing pieces.
Sure.
So it's kind of neat to have the original version that was published one way and then to have the new reprint edition, which may have had to make changes.
The Palmiotti Winslade book was Monolith. I was trying to
Monolith.
And it
That's
was really
was,
beautifully done book, but it just, It frittered out, but as a creator owned sort of independent project, it was actually a lovely book.
It was also like one of the earlier mainstream comics that featured a character that was HIV positive, to my memory. Yeah. Yeah, I had really fond memories of that. And then when I heard it was being reprinted, that image, I was like, yeah, ooh.
That's a problem.
No Batman.
Yeah, and there's
no
some Batman. Things that are like digital, web comics that have been put into books. Like Sunstone is something that had to be kind of reformatted and tweaked and changed around a bit to make sure that the narrative flowed in a trade. So stuff like that happens, or recolorings or things like that. Like Octopus Pie is coming out in color. So there's some things being added on. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's necessarily under director's cut, but it's definitely changing because of the formatting. And
right. It's probably not something that's so much different because the creative team pushed strongly for something. It's
because you can just go do creator-owned stuff if you feel really passionate about it, and you can have your say, so maybe it doesn't change as much, unless you deal with stuff like Mark Waid had to deal with. Then that's a different story. That feels like the more spot-on, like, director's cut sort of story.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. Thanks, y'all. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to Book Report, and let's start with Chris. What did you read this week?
Eric Powell has self-published a new series called Hillbilly at Albatross Press. And, you may know him from the Dark Horse Goon series. I'm sure he's been nominated for an Eisner. Maybe he won one. I can't remember. I have a love-hate relationship with him.
Exactly.
Because the thing is, I really loved The Goon for many years. But Powell started, like, having huge gaps of time between doing new issues. And I think he had some personal problems happening, so whatever. But he also started getting, like, really, really angry and whiny about mainstream comics. And it started to reflect in his works, but not in a constructive way. And when you really take, like, huge, huge gaps of time between runs, I start to just lose track. And after a while, The Goon just sort of reads the same after a while. Ooh. And I've heard that one of the last couple runs was really, really good, and him getting back on track, but I don't care. I thought I'd give this one a try. It looks great. It's like very folky. The hillbilly is kind of this eyeless guy roaming the woods, killing witches. It creates like a nice mythology, and it was spot on. This is the Eric Powell that I have missed. There's still an element of me that doesn't care anymore, because it still kind of reads the same to some of the Goon stuff. Like, he almost feels like a one-trick pony now. Mm. And I don't know if that's just me being tired.
Nope, that's not you. There's someone at this table who shares those feelings.
Yes. Is it Nicole? Because it's not me.
The Goon never did anything for me at all.
No?
Yeah. No.
And The Goon only
did
something for me for a narrow window of time.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I think he's a masterful creator at times. There's some sequences in his artwork that I think have been utterly beautiful, and some of the darker points of The Goon were great, and some of the more humorous points were fantastic. I will always love the psychic seal and the atomic brain and a bunch of other things like that. So yeah, it's good. If you really like The Goon, then you will love this, I think. And I think he's doing what he wants to do. It feels that way. So I hope he could kind of maintain momentum and be consistent with it. I just don't know if I'm going to check back in too often.
So, yeah. All right, cool. Hillbilly by Eric Powell. Thanks, Chris. Nicole, what about you?
So I wanted to follow up last week's Hanna-Barbera conversation with the Flintstones.
I was really curious about that book.
The Flintstones?
Yeah.
Oh, Steve Pugh, really?
I know!
No way!
Well, he did all new Invaders from Marvel a while ago, and I didn't read that, but his art was...
But you love him from...
But I love him from Hotwire.
Of course. She turned me on to Hotwire.
Yeah. Also that is the shark guy.
And Sharkman,
which is what Cole gave me that issue.
Right, because you introduced me to Hotwire, and I said, oh, you got to check out this. Right.
That's right.
Yeah. And
that's what friends are for. Steve Pugh comics. Okay, anyway.
He is a really brilliant illustrator.
He did the cover, which is a very throwback kind of like... No, he did the interior as well, but I had to get the Steve Pugh cover.
Oh.
Because he does this very watercolory kind of thing, which is what he did in Hotwire to a really great degree. Mm-hmm. But the interior is clean. Anyway, who wrote it? Let me say that because I'm like on the Steve Pugh train right now. Mark Russell is the writer. Steve Pugh does the interior. He's the main cover artist. And then, of course, there's a lot of other wonderful, wonderful human beings who are also doing a lot of side work. I always got to say that because I'm not going to spend 20 years saying their names. But So it starts off with, you know, like they're in a museum. It's a modern day museum, and they're like, hey, there's this guy.
Because they're the modern Stone Age family.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, this guy got frozen in ice, and the first issue is really just saying like his story, but you get introduced to, he's a side character. He's one of the Cro-Mags, you know, and they're like good labor workers, and they, you know, they're like small tribal guys, so they don't know about the big city and like, you know, money and material goods, right? Yeah, they're
not the modern Stone Age family.
They're not the modern Stone Age family, but we get Fred Flintstone, we get a little I think we get a little Barney action in here too. They go see a fight with the Cro-Mag guys, and they're all like, oh God, why is everybody fighting? This is so weird. And so you just get the world. It's a very setup issue.
Excellent.
You get that Wilma, she's an artist, but you know, she's not posh like the art people, so they don't understand her, and she doesn't understand them, and it's kind of sad. You get a little Betty action in there. So it was a really good first issue. I really enjoyed it.
How does it feel against the original?
Well, you get, you know, the little animal guys doing all the things, and they've got the hot tub, and, you know, with the rich guy who's the boss, and, you know.
Please tell me there's an animal in there who does a job and then just goes, it's a living.
I don't remember if it's that, but I think
is there a pig who's the garbage disposal?
And there are a lot of animals.
This is not a darkening of the Hanna-Barbera properties.
It's supposed to be satirical.
Because this is the writer, I think, who did the Prez.
Oh, right.
The new Prez stuff. Yep. And very, very politically satirical material.
See, there's all the animals like around her while she's on the phone, the horn phone. and they're like, she's, you know, what do you think this means about her painting? And he goes, I think it's more about the absence of meaning. Says one of the animals to the side.
I have to have that. So, can I have that book? I want that book.
The brush strokes she's not making, man.
So it's fun. Like, you still get like some pretty typical Flintstone stuff, but you know, there's a little bit of commentary in between there, and
I dig it.
It's fun. I'm really looking forward to reading more of it. Of course, I love supporting my Steve Pugh.
And this is a number one.
It's a number one.
Are they planning like a 7-9 issue?
That's what I was confused about all the Hanna-Barbera books. Are they ongoing? Are they?
They're probably ongoing
until they stop. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is them. DC putting stuff out there and being like, let's see if this sticks.
Okay.
Because I think that they're really excited. There's a couple people like Jim Lee who are just way excited about Hanna-Barbera and really want it to happen and be a thing. Yeah. And so we'll see. We'll see what lasts.
And Time Warner owns the property, so we got to do something with it.
Well, because I reviewed Scooby Apocalypse a couple weeks back, and you know, I was actually just hoping it was a 4-issue limited series, and that's all the more it was going to be. But if they're ongoing, that's kind of reshapes how.
I kind of feel like anything at DC right now is ongoing until it's not.
Until
ongoing.
It's not. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. At this point, they're trying a lot of stuff. So.
Okay.
Dictated by the almighty dollar.
That's right.
All right. Thanks, Nicole. Cole Hornaday.
Ongoing. Unless it's DK3, The Master Race, which blissfully will be concluded with book 6, I will not be reviewing this comic book today because I and everyone at this table are sick of me bitching about it. I'm actually going to talk about Astro City number 36.
Now, Astro,
bait and switch.
It's a twist.
Bait and switch. It's a twist. I think I've reviewed a couple of Astro Cities in the past. Astro City is a lovely book that's been around since 1996, and it's written by Kurt Busiek and drawn by Brent Anderson with covers by Alex Ross. It's a genre book that really does not challenge its readers, and in fact, sometimes I kind of think that Astro City is written for male, white, privileged comic book readers like myself, because it doesn't really, all the characters in it for the most part, are analogs to those we've met before. They're very clear liftings from DC and Marvel Universe. If anything, it's a celebration of all those genre stories. And sometimes there are challenging story arcs, like the animated lion character that gets brought to quote-unquote reality and lives his life as an animated being in this world of like flesh and blood humans. There are three lovely things about this book: the writing of Kurt Busiek, the art by Brent Anderson, and the covers by Alex Ross. Brent Anderson is not drawing the book anymore, and it really hurts the series now. This particular arc about Cracker Jack was drawn by a gentleman named I don't think it's Ron Randall. It's Randall, but just not as strong an illustrator as Brent Anderson. And Brent Anderson has been drawing the book. Yeah, it is Ron Randall. Brent Anderson has been drawing the book, you know, since its inception back in 95. And that hurt my enjoyment of the story. And I'm afraid that if Randall continues to draw it, I don't know if I can keep invested in it, because I was really hooked on that creative team. But also, when the story's flagged, there was always that lovely Brent Anderson artwork. And I don't think Randall is that strong an illustrator. And what Busiek is doing with the book is not really what I would consider a challenge to the reader. So it's a toughie. But maybe this was just a slow arc. So do you follow this book at all?
So remember they did the Dark Ages?
Yes.
That's where they took forever.
Yes.
They hit some really big late schedule stuff.
Yeah.
And the stories just got boring to me.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime they focus too much on the heroes themselves.
Yeah.
Because they're set pieces. They should be just set pieces. Mm-hmm. My favorite story is the Tarnished Angel one.
Yeah.
Anything where they take either the man on the street point of view or a character that you never hear from,
mm-hmm.
and then they play the archetype differently.
Yeah.
That's what I love. Whenever they focus on their Superman, their Crusader Batman,
yep.
this is Jack in a Box, he's Spider-Man.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't care.
Yep.
I'll just go read Spider-Man, Batman, yep. or Superman.
I feel the same way. And really good point about Busiek's handling of Man on the Street, probably a book that I never sing praises of enough, is the book Marvels that he did in the 90s, which, you know, was what put he and Alex Ross on the scene. And that was the story of the entire Marvel universe up to that point in time, told from the Man on the Street's perspective. And it reinvigorated my investment in Marvel Comics as a whole. I thought it was an inspired story. And every once in a while, Ben Lawrence will ask, you know, well, what's a good road traveling? What's a good road trip book? Or what's a good internet? And I always forget to mention Marvels, maybe because it's just, you know, always so deeply resonant with me. I forget it's there.
It's
because it's one
of
my favorite things.
I think a lot of people have forgotten about it. It's worth revisiting.
It's good.
Yeah.
I love that.
And so Astro City number 36.
Cool. Thanks, Cole.
You're welcome.
Well, that's a book report, and that's our show, and coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by the Panel Jumper. See everything that Cole Hornaday and I do at
thepaneljumper.com.
All right. Exactly like that. And the Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street here in beautiful downtown Wallingford. Ta-da!
24/7, rain or shine.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week at...
Oh, sorry. Thepaneljumper.com. No, wait.
No. ComicsDungeon.com. All right. You can email us at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com.
It's like 11 for us.
Yeah. Right?
Subscribe.
It's late.
Subscribe to us at perfectboundpodcast.com or at iTunes. Leave us a review. We've gotten a couple nice reviews on iTunes from some lovely people who mm-hmm. listen to the show, and mm-hmm. I know both of them.
Yep.
And
our Patreon supporters as well.
Our Patreon supporters. I know all of those. Well, I know of them. I've never met John, but anyway. John, I look forward to meeting you. You're a very nice fellow, and a great contributor to Quiz Time. Mm-hmm, Speaking of Quiz Time, get your quiz hats on, everybody.
Yay!
Today, these questions come to us from me.
What?
This one is called, Go Ahead, Ban Me.
Yay.
Try to guess the comics which concerned citizens tried to get banned from their local libraries. Oh. This is courtesy of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, cbldf.org. Mm-hmm. All right, number one. In May 2013, a patron of the public library in Columbus, Nebraska, requested that this book be removed from the collection, claiming that it advocates rape and violence. 3 out of 5 library board members were present at the meeting where the challenge was considered, and they voted unanimously to retain on the shelves this one shot by Alan Moore and Brian Bolland.
The Killing Joke.
Of course, it's a killing joke.
Yeah, we could have all said it. You know.
Number two, this book, an autobiographical memoir by Craig Thompson, was challenged by a citizen of Marshall, Missouri, to have it removed from that city's public library because of allegedly obscene images. This citizen likened the illustrations to pornography and was concerned that the comic art would attract children who would subsequently see the images she alleged were pornographic. Mm-hmm. Anybody know the book?
Is it Blankets?
It is Blankets. Yeah. The library's board of trustees adopted a material selection policy and, after a letter from the CBLDF, restored to circulation Blankets, as well as Alison Bechdel's Fun Home, which was also banned. Number three, in 2009, this book, a British series set in post-apocalyptic Australia, which follows the adventures of a multicolored-haired lass, her mutant kangaroo boyfriend Booga, and a varied cast of secondary heroes and villains, was challenged at the Hammond Public Library in Hammond, Indiana. A library patron asked that the book be removed for the depiction of nudity and violence. The library chose to retain the book,
sex.
And it remained on and remains on shelves today. And the answer is, all at once,
Tank Girl.
Number four, in 2013, this book by Jeff Smith about a group of outcasts who find themselves in a valley surrounded by talking bugs, vicious rat-like monsters, magic, and the occasional dragon.
That's ridiculous.
Was number 10 on the American Library Association's list of most challenged books because of its depictions of drinking and smoking. The answer is
so bone.
It is bone, of course.
But that's like the one that like kids usually come in having read already in the comic book store.
Number 10. I mean, it's number 10 on the ALA's list of challenged books. All right, and finally, number five, in February 2015, the CBLDF was confidentially involved in the defense of this graphic novel, an adaptation of a Neil Gaiman novel, which was challenged in an undisclosed middle school for violent imagery. Anybody know the answer yet?
Murder mysteries?
No. This, I have more questions. The full-color graphic novel tells the story of Nobody Owens, a boy raised by ghosts, and his adventures through the graveyard where he lives. Yes, the graveyard book. Huh. CBLDF's defense was successful. The review committee voted to keep the book on library shelves. All right, and that's our quiz time, and that is our show.
Nice job, Ben Lawrence.
Thank you for listening, and we will see you all next week.